Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, prescribing hope for healthy families here on American Family Radio. Here's your host, Professor, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, and Mom of Four, Dr. Jessica Peck.
Well, hello, friends. I am so excited to come to you today with a real treat for me. I have for you as my guest, a fellow colleague at Baylor University. How exciting is that? So if you are a Baylor alum, if you have a kid at Baylor, if you've worked for Baylor or any sort of Baylor fan, we'll just give a collective sic'em bears right here at the beginning. Okay, that's out of the way. Now, my guest today is Dr. Holly Oxhandler. She is an associate professor and associate dean for research and faculty development at Baylor's Diana R. Garland School of Social Work. Now, for over a decade, Dr. Oxhandler has studied and developed tools to assess mental health care providers, integration of spirituality in treatment, and she helps professionals infuse their own faith in their work and the client's views towards discussing spirituality and mental health care. She has written extensively for professional journals within social work and psychology. Her research has been featured in the Washington Post, Religion News Service, and she co-hosts the weekly podcast CXMH, a podcast on faith and mental health. Now, today we'll be talking about her book. Her book is called The Soul of the Helper, Seven Stages to Seeing the Sacred Within Yourself So You Can See It in Others. So we are really going to dive into this intersection of mental health and faith, which they are not isolated, but they can't be separated. And so they're different things, but they can't be separated. So this is something, if you're a regular listener of the show, you know we revisit this topic all the time. There is so much to talk about, as Holly talks about weekly on her podcast, just on this topic. Holly, welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show. We're so glad to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Jessica. I am so honored to be here and grateful for this chance just to connect with you today. This is a gift.
It is a gift, and I can't wait to share it with everybody. It's like a gift that everybody gets, and so that's really exciting. Now, one of the gifts that you gave us in this book, Holly, The Soul of the Helper, is you gave us the gift of your story. There are a lot of professors, you and I know a lot of them, who it's so comfortable to write from an academic space, right? Like, oh, here's what I've learned, and here's what you should do. But you are very transparent in interjecting your story throughout your book, saying, here's what I've learned. Here's how I struggled through it. Here's how it applied to me. So let's just start with a little bit of your story. Tell us who you are, how your family came to be, and what role faith played in all of that.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for that question, just for opening up the door for the story. I really do appreciate it. I will say, to your point, like, yes, I'm very mindful that academics at times, we can hide behind research in a lot of ways, or we'll just point to the research happening over there. But I will say, as somebody who has been doing this research on spirituality and mental health, for as long as I have, I really did get to a point where I couldn't just keep pointing to the research without wrestling with it within my own life. So there got to be a point where I couldn't not step into the story or be more transparent about it. And I'm grateful for the chance to have done that. But a little bit just about me and how my family came to be. I'm originally from upstate New York. I grew up Catholic and attended Catholic school my whole life growing up until my first semester in college. I moved to Texas in the early 2000s and in Houston specifically. And I met my husband shortly after that. We got married in 2011. We have a couple of kiddos ourselves. We have a second grader and a sixth grader. And we moved to Waco after I finished my PhD in social work. So my undergrad is in psychology from the University of Houston. My master's is in social work. And then my PhD is in social work. And then I really have been given this incredible opportunity of getting to work at Baylor, where I can wrestle with these topics and study these topics professionally in such a way that I really hope serves mental health care providers and those who are seeking mental health services. So that's a little bit about who I am and my family. I will say my faith is still very important to me. I don't still identify as Catholic, but I am Christian, and it is, my faith is just deeply embedded throughout all of who I am, including my approach to my work, my relationships, my family. My relationship with God is just so important to who I am and has carried me through a lot of seasons, both good and hard seasons, which I imagine that many of your listeners probably resonate with. So yeah, that's just a little bit about me and my story. Well, but I think we'll probably go into some other layers in a moment. So
we're going to dive into some of those layers. And Holly, it's funny because we have a few things in common here. First of all, I married a Reformed Catholic, a former Catholic. And also I identify with what you're saying about hiding as an academic behind my story. So when I was writing my book Behind Closed Doors, you know, I really wrote from that space. And my editor, the first pass, said, "This is such great information, but you're really unapproachable and unrelatable and quite frankly, like kind of unlikable." And I thought, oh, this is so painful. So my sister helped write this little paragraph of my story. My editor says, oh, that's it. That's the story. That's it. And I thought, thank you. I wrote 50,000 words, but you like the 100 words that my sister wrote the best. Oh, wonderful. I'm feeling very confident in my academics here. But the last thing, the third thing that we have in common from what you just said is our appreciation for working at a faith-based university. So I came from state schools where that was just separate. And when I went to my first Baylor meeting, they opened with prayer and I'm kind of looking around like, we do that. And I have shared that space with you of wrestling with that, you know, the things that I know professionally, but also the intersection of our faith. And that is where you dive in deep in this book. Like I said, the intersection of mental health and faith. So in Soul of the Helper, you share your own story of struggling with your parents' divorce as a child and trying to interpret that through the lens of your Catholic faith. And you actually shared a really heartbreaking story about having an overnight bag at school and your teacher announcing, if you're divorced, you're going to hell. I want you to tell this story because this event, as you share, served as a catalyst for a faith crisis. And when you learned that all helpers aren't really helpful. So tell us, take us to that moment.
For our listeners, I talk a little bit, I'll say first that there are some layers of trauma and abuse that I don't go into significant detail about within the book, but I do indicate that, you know, there were some things that led up to my parents' divorce. And so as we were going through that separation season, or my parents were going through that, it started when I was in fourth grade. And this moment that you're talking about, I mean, I was in a Catholic school. I would bring an overnight bag because it was Monday and Tuesday at mom's, Wednesday and Thursday at dad's, every other weekend, you know, alternating between the homes. And I remember very clearly the moment that my teacher was teaching us our religion class and had shared this. And I remember all of my classmates like turning and looking at me because our family was the only one that I knew of who was going through a divorce in the entire school. And so, you know, I just remember feeling this overwhelming sense of, you know, what do I do with this? How do I fit all of this together? Knowing that, you know, divorce is not, certainly not something to take lightly by any means. And as a social worker and mental health care provider, and as a child of a family that has experienced divorce, I know that sometimes divorce is necessary. And so trying to wrestle with all of that, as, you know, with my 10-year-old heart and awareness of the world, you know, I just think back to that younger part of me, my heart just breaks because she was trying to do her best to, you know, be 10, but then also to navigate this trauma of the divorce, but also the things that led up to the divorce. And so I remember it really, to your point about it, kind of serving as this catalyst for a faith crisis, or this beginning of recognizing ways in which the container of faith that I had been raised in had cracks, that I hadn't really, you know, I hadn't had a need to really think through them or explore them, but there was just this dissonance between hearing what my religion teacher was saying and then thinking within my own family's context, like, but this is something that's good. And it's not that divorce is good, but for what my mom and sister and I had experienced, like, this was a good path for my mom to begin to lead us down and to begin the process of the divorce. So I didn't know how to, those two things didn't mesh with what my teacher had said. And so it really pushed me into a season of wrestling with layers of my faith and teachings that I had experienced or had heard, even thinking about, you know, the Ten Commandments, which is taught heavily within Catholic school, and getting to the commandment on honoring thy mother and thy father, and thinking like, well, you know, I love both of my parents, but like, what does honoring a parent look like who has caused pain and trauma and abuse? And how does that fit with what God wants for us, and including our own safety? So that's a little bit of that story in particular, but it certainly set the course for a lot of wrestling, critical thinking, questioning, leaning on God through these seasons, and just wrestling with it all.
Holly, it continues to amaze me how parallel in so many ways our paths were. Now, my parents did not get divorced, but I had experienced a lot of trauma and emotional neglect and other things like that. And I found myself in counseling and with a therapist and asking that same question, like, but I've got to honor my parents. And at the same time, you know, they were honoring them, and their eyes were things that were deeply dishonoring to me. And I remember the therapist asking me, saying, well, you know, have you been arrested? I was so thrown off. And I said, well, no. And he said, do you love your husband? I said, yes. And he said, do you try to be a good mom? And I said, yes. And he said, do you go to church regularly? I said, yes. And he said, do you, you know, serve in your community? And I really, you know, kind of puzzled at where this was going. And I said, yes. And he said, well, how is that not honoring to your parents? It says, the Bible says, honor your parents, not worship your parents. And that is really hard. Now, you share the importance of having therapists during this time, and you even list by name several that you thank, which I thought was so sweet and precious. But you said that when you first shared your struggles, the priests were speechless and the therapists were hopeful, but were not equipped to talk about those faith implications. And it made you feel ashamed, which just breaks my heart, Holly. I feel like I want to go back to that little girl, Holly, and just say, hey, you're going to be okay. But how did that experience bring you full circle to writing a book to equip helpers to help us in our faith?
Yeah. Oh, that's such a good question. Yeah. I will say I am very thankful that my mom, when she started, you know, this process of leaving my biological father, and when she started kind of moving through her own work, she started going to therapy herself. And that is one of the things that I am most grateful for, that, you know, I can talk about a little bit more later, but she was doing that work herself. And then she also, you know, opened up the door for my sister and I to get mental health treatment. Now, I know that this is not always accessible and available to everyone for lots of layers and reasons, whether geographically or financially or whatever the case may be, but I do know that there are more and increased efforts to make mental health care more accessible, especially because of the rate and prevalence that we are beginning to see around mental health needs. And so I want to
I'm going to pause you. I'm going to pause you right there, Holly. We are coming up on a break, but we are going to pick up right where we left off when we come back. Don't go away.
You're listening to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show with Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, friends. We are in the middle of a really heartwarming, heartbreaking, heart-touching conversation with Dr. Holly Oxhandler, who is my colleague at Baylor University. She is the Associate Dean for Research and Faculty at the School of Social Work. And Holly has been sharing her story of her parents' divorce and how that impacted her faith. And when we left for the break, she was just telling us about starting her journey and seeking out mental health treatment. And Holly, I really want to go back to what you were saying. You're right in that sometimes it can be really challenging for issues of access, which is a whole complicated topic in and of itself. Yeah. But I do want to go back and rest on the fact that you really call out your mom for having the courage and the compassion to take you to therapy and to also get therapy for herself. Because I think that is one of the greatest gifts that we can give our children. If we do not deal with our own trauma, it will become our children's burden to bear. So I'll let you finish your thoughts on what you were sharing with us.
Yeah, well, thank you for elevating that and highlighting it, because I think that is one of the most, that is a really important piece in this, that I am deeply grateful to my mom for doing that inner work, as scary and challenging as it may have been. But to your question too about like how the experience of these therapists as well as the priest, like how that shaped writing this book, I would say that, you know, first I want to note that thankfully not all of my therapists were like, you know, overtly not equipped to talk about this. There was one in particular that I write about who, when I brought up my faith, her response was, "We don't talk about that in here." And that was really hard to receive. Wow. As a client, because, and this was before my PhD program, because at that point, like, I didn't know as a client, like, oh, if I can't talk about this, like, this is a big part of who I am. It kind of intersects with all of the other things I'm going to talk about. But that was one. Many of the others that I write about really did a beautiful job of holding space for me to explore my faith and how it related to my situation. They offered this grounded, non-judgmental space for me to wrestle with my faith and my questions about, you know, where was God in these situations that I was navigating or why things were happening. And they allowed me to bring my faith into the conversation. They never imposed their faith onto me, which as mental health care providers, we know that that is not ethical for a licensed mental health care provider to impose their faith. But they held this beautiful space for me to talk about my faith because they had already done so much of their own inner work around their own beliefs, their own faith, and how it fits within their lives so that they could hold that space for me to begin to heal.
Well, you know what I love about your story? There's so many things that I love, Holly, but one of the things that I love is it's such a but God story. You know, really, you could have gone in so many different directions as we see kids who experience trauma and abuse. Yeah. Like you did.
Yeah.
But you are a highly accomplished academic, researcher, and this experience that you had, this personal experience, deeply impacted the research that you do. And I think it's so beautiful that now you are equipping hundreds, if not thousands, of helpers across the world to be able to do that and to do it well. Now, I want to dive into your book because that led, you know, your academic journey led obviously to this book. And I'm going to slow walk this because I think that the description is so beautiful. And listen, it doesn't matter if you're listening, if you're a social worker or a nurse or a parent or any kind of helper, this book is for all helpers. So listen in. This is what Holly says. There are many kinds of helpers in our world, the caregivers among us. They are the social workers who serve the vulnerable, the nurses and doctors who treat the ill, the teachers who instruct the young, the first responders who rescue the imperiled, the faith leaders who comfort the congregation, the volunteers who support the community. And whether or not it is our professional calling, Each of us is likely to serve as a caregiver at some point in our lives, as a parent raising a child, or as a loved one caring for an aging relative. These and many other efforts to serve are among the most noble pursuits we can imagine, but they come with a danger worth recognizing. In their devotion to the well-being of others, caregivers, that's us, friends, every one of us, routinely put their own well-being last and can unintentionally burn themselves out physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Their self-neglect paired alongside a deep desire to help others has the potential to stir up feelings of anger and resentment, leading to a sense of guilt and shame. They often believe that if they were to grant themselves any rest or grace, they would be at risk of failing in their duty. In The Soul of the Helper, Dr. Holly Oxhandler shows caregivers and fellow helpers a more self-compassionate way to cope. And don't we all need this? She invites us to cope with our overwhelming responsibilities, to attend to our own needs, particularly when it comes to mental health and spiritual journey. She is inviting us, friends. She is inviting us right now to pause and realize that if we let our personal resources run dry, we cannot possibly care for others as fully as they wish. In fact, our efforts are likely to cause more harm than good. Holly, if people aren't on their Amazon cart right now, like saying, I need this book, like this applies to all of us. And so we're going to I want to walk through some of the elements that are here. The first thing that I want to talk about is something that comes up in conversation a lot in my professional circles, but among my listeners too. You share in the introduction of this book that 90% of adults in the U.S. believe in God, but only about a third of psychologists believe in a personal God, and very few psychology programs include attention to faith or religious curricular content. And you asked yourself, shouldn't these therapists be trained to help their clients bridge this gap? And this has led you to a 13-year journey, and you share that sophisticated, high quality, the best research demonstrates that considering a person's faith and mental health treatment often helps them heal faster with longer lasting outcomes. Holly, I am so convicted. Like, this is me as a mom. I'm burned out, stressed out, overworked, overtired, overcommitted, all those things. What hope can you offer us in this? You know, okay, you've got us convicted. Where do we go from there?
Yeah. Well, at least when it relates to these mental health care providers, I recognize, as you mentioned, that they have not received training. And I think a lot of times mental health care providers, you know, and that includes psychologists, counselors, marriage and family therapists, social workers, nurses. I've done research with nurses as well. But, you know, without that guidance and training on how to talk about it with clients, I think a lot of times these mental health care providers are like, I don't know how to talk about it. And then at the same time, there are clients sitting in the room like, I don't know how to talk about this. Or if I can. But for those of us who are, you know, these everyday helpers, as you mentioned, parents or spouses or caregivers or faith leaders, like, this is us. Like, this is us in terms of thinking about how do we pay attention to our own mental health journeys and how it overlaps with our faith as we care for others. I want to recognize and name that, you know, we see that over 80% of us across the U.S. will meet criteria for a diagnosable mental illness at some point in our lives. So this is almost all of us. And I even question, you know, the 17% who it didn't. It was kind of like, well, you know, maybe eventually it's going to get there. But these researchers compare that, you know, just like physical illness, that we're all going to experience a cold or the flu or strep throat, like our minds are not immune to mental health struggles. And so these everyday helpers who, to your point, include, you know, parents, nurses, those who are just going and going to the best of their ability. Like, I really hope the listener hears that. I know that all of those things tugging at your attention to go and do and help and serve, they're underneath it, there is this desire to do good and help. And I wholeheartedly applaud that. And as you mentioned, we really have to be caring for ourselves and our own intersection of our faith and our mental health as we serve others, so that, to your point, we don't unintentionally cause harm, and so that we don't miss, you know, what it is that folks need, and we don't assume or project or, you know, incorrectly try to meet a need that is not the actual need. But we've got to do this inner work. And so, yes, I could go down the path on the research side if you wanted me to a little bit, but
yeah, let's drill down specifically on what I feel like our listeners might be recognizing as this discrepancy. We're saying faith is integral to who we are. Faith is at the core of everything that we have. And when we have deeply held spiritual convictions, like, we can't separate those from our mental health and say, okay, well, I'm just here to treat my brain, but I'm going to set this to the side. But we've also said that psychologists or other mental health professionals are ill-equipped to do that. And we're also saying, yeah, but you should go see one. So what do you say to discrepancy? Like, how do we reconcile those contradictory elements, however you want to take it, research or not? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I'll say that this is a big line of research that my colleagues and I are doing right now to try to bridge the gap on the training. So I'll at least bring that up and mention that several of us, we have a $5 million grant through the John Templeton Foundation, where we are trying to do better in terms of equipping these mental health care providers to consider this area of people's lives and treatment. At the same time, a lot of the research that I've done too has been more out of a desire to empower clients, because in social work, we really care about it being person-centered, person-focused, and empowering and clients and tapping into their strengths and resources. And so I've tried to do a lot of research to better understand, what do clients want? And they do want to talk about this area of their lives. They consider their faith to be relevant to their mental health. And we do have research that shows that when the provider talks about or includes or assesses for the client's faith, it actually improves treatment outcomes than if it were to just not be included. And that's because, like what you said, like, our faith is part of our values. It's a part of our worldview. It's how we cope with difficult situations. And at the same time, for some folks, we also know that their faith can be a place of pain, that they may have experienced some wrestling or struggles, that, you know, that they're wondering, you know, where are you, God, in this situation? And so, you know, all of these layers of complexity around this area of people's lives has to be taken into account with care and compassion, with the mental health care provider kind of leading that. But I also really want to empower clients to, you know, if this is an important part of who you are, then I really hope that you feel the encouragement to bring this up, just like if you were to bring up the fact that you're a parent or the type of work that you do or where you grew up in or your culture. You know, this is a part of who you are that belongs in the treatment setting.
You know, you said in your book that it was very interesting to me that in your research, you found that when you surveyed therapists over half said the therapist should bring up your faith and 17% said the client should bring up their faith. And so they're thinking, but 4 or 5 adults want to discuss faith as it relates to their mental health. So that's another disconnect that I see, and something really important in empowering you as a client to go in there and say, this is an integral part of who I am and what I'm looking for. And frankly, if you're not equipped to lead me through that, then this is not going to be a good partnership. And I think we have to take more empowerment in that and realize that, especially when we're talking with a counselor or a therapist, it may take a few tries to get that right fit. What do you think about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. I do think that it can take a few tries to find the right fit. That definitely is the case. And I also know that there are a lot of really well-skilled mental health care providers who humbly will recognize, you know, I don't know a whole lot about this faith tradition or this culture, but just like they refer out for other things, you know, we also encourage, like, I mean, it's in alignment with our code of ethics to refer out when something is beyond our competency. So if a provider needs to refer out for maybe a very specific spiritual struggle, that the mental health care provider is not trained to navigate that spiritual struggle, but they will help connect with a faith leader to kind of walk through some of that, I think that's fine and that's good. So long as the provider is able to at least hold that space for the client to bring this part of who they are into treatment and say, this is who you are, like that belongs in this space. Because my job, I mean, so much of what mental health care providers are doing are trying to bring pieces of individuals into the state of wholeness. Integrate these pieces of the individual through a healing process that, again, I don't think it can be done without considering the faith of the client, especially if that is important for the client yes. and an important part of their life.
And that's the importance of holistic health. I mean, it takes a village. And so from some, you might learn some different coping strategies that are helpful. And from another, you might get great encouragement and restoration of your faith. You said in your book that mental health struggles don't make you weak or weird. They make you human. And a lot of times the trauma that we experience that causes us to seek help, it's not our fault, but it does become our responsibility to manage it. Now, when we come back, Holly, I want to dive into your journey as a new working mom and the fact that helpers ourselves are not perfect and what happens when the helper needs the help. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Podcasts of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show are available on the podcast page at AFR.net. Now, back to Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, friends. You are joining me for a conversation with one of my Baylor colleagues, Dr. Holly Oxhandler, who wrote The Soul of the Helper, 7 Stages to Seeing the Sacred Within Yourself so You Can See It in Others. And we have talked about her personal journey that led her to her professor journey. And then we're going to circle back now, Holly, to some of that personal journey that you experienced after therapy, after becoming a professor and teaching other people how to do things and then realizing, oh, wait, maybe I need this myself, which, Holly, let me just tell you, I can so relate to because my book, Behind Closed Doors, starts, the opening scene is my daughter throwing a book at my head while I was driving when she was 13 years old. So clearly I had some things to learn and some things to share. And so I want to read to you one of the things that you read in your book, read for our listeners. You said, when you first went to a church, a support group, you said, this is the speech that you wrote out. Hi, my name is Holly. I'm recovering from perfectionism, overachievement, people pleasing, and hustling for worthiness, accolades, and affirmations. I also admit to using various tactics such as checking the news, email, and social media for superficial connection to numb out and to remove myself from the present moment. And you talked about how hard it was for you to say that, just those few sentences, but my goodness, I mean, I could have just said, hi, my name is Jessica, and then said the exact same thing. You are definitely not alone. And you start off sharing in this book, you know, you're a working mom, you had a baby and like a really difficult circumstance as far as working and benefits and all those things. And you just found yourself overwhelmed by the fast and furious pace of the world. So what happened, Holly?
Yeah, well, I really appreciate you elevating that piece from that support group at our church that I loved being a part of. And I feel like it was so instrumental in the process even of the book and with the work that I'm doing now. To the pieces that you just shared, one of the other things that I said right after naming all of those struggles was that I don't know how to slow down. And that was, I think, that was the point at which my pride shattered. Because I think for helpers, there's a lot of ways that we move through the things that we have to do, or we, you know, air quote, have to do. And we just go and do and help and serve, and, you know, and people support it and they encourage it and they praise us for it and thank us for it. And for those of us who help, I mean, the reality is we receive, those bumps of dopamine when we get those accolades or affirmations or that support that's like, yes, keep doing that. But the reality is that we're human beings. We're not human doings. We can't just go without pause and rest, which is why Sabbath is just so important for us. But to your question around, you know, thinking back to that season of like after my daughter was born, like I think that there were a few moments throughout my journey that God really stepped in and very clearly was like, I have something to teach you. And and the only way for you to really hear it is for like everything to change, right? I don't know if anybody else has had similar experiences like this.
Me.
But I do know that after our daughter was born, it was like, you know, I will say that, and you will understand this, but it was like, I finished coursework in May. I did my comps exam, which is a big exam in your PhD program, in June. I defended my dissertation proposal in July, and then our daughter was born in August.
Oh my goodness.
And then like once.
What great timing,
oh,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was like, you know, I just really have this bent toward I can do it all and I can do it all really well and watch me go. And then there's just a point where it's like you remember or you're reminded that control is an illusion and there's only so much that you can do. And so, you know, I can't perfectly plan out how to do everything and tackle it all. And that was very true after my daughter was born, which I write pretty candidly about, and the burnout that overlapped with that season, along with experiences of postpartum depression and postpartum anxiety. And certainly that arose again after my son was born. And I'm very grateful that Baylor offers a pretty generous maternal leave policy that a lot of institutions don't. And so that offered me some time to just to be and connect with my son. But again, for helpers who are so wired to just go, 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 for anything that slows us down, it's really difficult and painful to then not just be running and going. I use the analogy in the book of like, you know, if you're driving on a highway that's like 70 miles per hour and you go to get off at an off ramp that, you know, goes down to 40 miles per hour and then you go to get on a street that's like 20, you feel it in your being when you're going from 70 down to 20 miles per hour. And that I feel like it says a lot about that experience for helpers when they need to slow down, as difficult as it is.
It's so true. And I really appreciate how candid and relatable you were in sharing those struggles as a new mother. Now, your struggles from your fast pace were a lot from working, from academic pressures, which I can certainly relate to. But
yes.
So many moms,
yeah,
they have other pressures. It may be caring for your ailing parents or having other kids at home or children with special needs or doing something that seems so good, like volunteering in your community or serving your church. And I think there is no parent out there, especially moms, who cannot relate to that. And you share that you actually ended up at a physician, and you said that your doctor wrote down this prescription, which I'm going to share with our listeners because I loved this. This was your prescription for this. It was 12 things right here. You had 12 prescriptions. Okay, Holly. So, you know, I can relate. These prescriptions were say no once a week, shut off your email dinger and hide the number of emails in your inbox. Allow a predetermined amount of time for email daily. Prioritize responses to email by importance. Spend 10 minutes outside twice a day. Walk in the office and spend time in prayer. Exercise 3 times a week. Eat clean or minimally processed foods at least once a day. Read to the kids 3 nights a week. Have a weekly date night. Set a nightly bedtime and limit email time at home and put your phone away for a set time. And I think, you know, Holly, when people go to a healthcare provider, that's how it's supposed to go. They're so afraid that they're just going to get a prescription and just, you know, numb out and just that's all that it is. But it takes these things that I always say are very simple, but not easy. And you call this a countercultural pace, which I love that term. I'm completely stealing that and using that all the time now. But how pivotal was that prescription that you got in the accountability in your search for enoughness is what you call it?
Yeah, well, it absolutely was pivotal because I recognize that the medical system, you know, our doctors and nurses, they don't have a lot of time with each patient. They can't hear all of the layers of everything for every patient. And that's very difficult for a lot of systemic reasons. I also was not expecting for him to sit down, and he did give me the time to hear what was going on. And for him, I mean, I really did. I went into the meeting being like, I'm burned out. I'm exhausted. I have nothing left to give. And I really thought he was going to prescribe me something to at least help me through the season. But he didn't. He took this completely different approach. And it not only helped me recognize that there were some things that I could do. And to be very clear, you read through that list. I hope our listeners, they're not thinking like, you know, oh, she can perfectly do every single one of them every single day. She's checking them off like perfectly. There's a lot of ebb and flow. Please hear me that there's a lot of ebb and flow, but it provides a guidance for me to be like, oh, that's right. I haven't read to the kids this week. And that's something that's really meaningful for me. So I'm going to pivot back to integrate that into my evenings for next week. Maybe I don't get a date night in with my husband like I'd like, but I'm, you know, there's an ebb and flow to it. But it really did help me start to shift my perspective on my priorities. It helped me to have people to hold me accountable, being my doctor and my husband who sat in that appointment with me, and to have others looking at this with me who cared for me. And then it did, to your point, it really did help me to begin to see a little bit more clearly that I am worth caring for, that these things that I may like kind of toss off as like, oh, I don't have time for that. They're really important things that I need to be integrating into my life to care for myself well so that I can care for the people around me well.
Well, and that led you to the Namaste theory for everyday helpers. So introduce us to that. What in the world does that mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. So with the research that I was doing for mental health care providers, I found that the mental health care providers who were more motivated to live out their faith and who are motivated to just embody their faith, they were more likely to ethically consider their clients' faith in mental health treatment. This pattern showed up not just with social workers, but with counselors and marriage and family therapists, and nurses and psychologists. And as I, you know, as we talked about before, the research that we do, like there is a bidirectional process and there are ways that it changes us. And so as I wrestled with this research, this term namaste, its origins are, it's originally a Sanskrit term that literally translates to mean I bow to you. But more generally, we understand it to mean the sacred in me recognizes the sacred in you, or the image of God in me sees and honors the image of God in you. And that brought order to the research I was doing with mental health care providers. But as I was talking about it with helpers in general, it became very clear that this is relevant for everyday helpers, that as we as helpers begin to recognize and see the sacred within ourselves, we are better positioned to see and honor the sacred or the image of God within those that we help and serve. And I think it allows us just to recognize the image of God within us in such a way that we see our own inherent worth, that we see that we bear the image of God that is worth caring for within us. That as helpers, we may not be thinking about that as we're going out and helping and doing and serving and doing all of the things, but we've got to tune in and care for this part of us. It's not our ego. It's not our false self. It's not the parts of me that I want to grow big or anything like that. It is that still small voice, that quiet part of me that God is a part of and resides within, and that is worth caring for as I serve others.
Well, you know, Holly, that deeply resonates me because if you think about that perspective, if you walk around looking for the image of God in others and the image of God in yourselves and yourself, I mean, that could completely shift your whole mindset, because a lot of times when we get frustrated with somebody, you know, we are angry, you know, with the teller who's taking too long or the person who's writing a paper check in front of us. I mean, maybe that simple kind of interaction, or just getting frustrated with our kids, you know, losing our temper and just thinking, I don't have anything else to give. If we're not looking at them, seeing the image of God, then our heart is not set to really help them or serve them well. But conversely, Holly, I think looking for the image of God in ourselves, I think sometimes we just think, oh my goodness, we have to do everything. And if we don't do these things, the world is going to fall apart. And what a flimsy view of God that is, that, hey, if I stop, man, God's going to really have a problem on his assembly line here. I don't know if he'll be able to accomplish his plan. And if we really think about that, that is terrible. Well, Holly, we could talk for forever. I cannot believe we're at the end of our time. We just have a couple minutes left, but give our listeners some insight into this 7-stage journey of seeking the sacred. What will they find in this book?
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you. So in the second part of this book, there is a 7-stage journey of seeking the sacred. It begins, each chapter begins with S. It is speed, slow, steady, still, see, shift, and serve. And the underpinning message within it is this recognition that helpers need to wake up to the speed and pace that they operate through life, to then slow down, to identify those steadying structures to help them move at a slower pace, because that's difficult for us, so that we can actually be still, because it's not until we are still that we can actually see the sacred within. And I have this beautiful analogy about water being still. Like, we can't see into the deep until we are still. And from that sense of seeing, we shift with compassion toward ourselves and others and serve from a place of knowing that we are enough and that we are beloved. There is a degree of humility to what you were just saying. Like, we can't do it all, but we can trust that God is doing what is God's to do, and we can do what is ours to do and trust it's enough in the process.
That is beautiful. Holly, we're at the end of our time, but that is beautiful. God is enough. We'll see you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.